listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
We are continuing our history series today, taking a look at the Puritan movement with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. Thanks to Concordia University Wisconsin for supporting The Coffee Hour. Find out more about Concordia University Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
Joining us today, the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Great.
I'm so excited.
We are ready to dig into more history as we continue to learn about the Puritan movement. So we're still in England, and
yes.
Now we're looking at what's the state of the church at the time that Charles I becomes king?
Yeah, Charles I is where the whole Puritan movement comes to a head, so we want to get there. But in order to get there in a way that makes sense to people, we need to talk about the state of the church as it had developed under James and then was inherited by Charles I. Basically, James, King of Scotland, pretty solid amateur theologian, was a Calvinist, and the Church of England was officially Calvinist, 39 articles, very much compatible with Calvinism. So that's kind of where the establishment was. However, it's also true that we are now a couple of generations past the establishment of Protestantism in England. We have more people who were not involved in the origins growing up in that church, going to school, going to Oxford, going to Cambridge, opting for a career in the church that got support, patrons, and the like. And not all of them are hardcore Calvinists, and not all of them are appreciative of the Puritan movement to try to make the Church of England different and presumably better than it had been. They're the type of people who say, well, no, I think it's pretty good the way it is now, and I'm not so sure that we ought to be just endorsing everything that the Reformed churches, the theologians on the continent, have always said. We've got it pretty good here in England, too. So we get the development of, let's call it an anti-Calvinist or an anti-Puritan faction within the Church of England. And these are people who, for theological grounds, will differ with the Calvinist, or for matters of church polity, will start to kind of emphasize the importance of having bishops rather than other forms of church government, or will be people who have grown up with the Book of Common Prayer and really think that it's pretty good the way it is, and they want to keep it, they appreciate it, and they're not too happy with those who always are kind of criticizing it or trying to violate it. So we've got these two factions developing. And I thought it would be helpful to your listeners to think a little bit about theological issues at this point, because on the continent, particularly in the Dutch Netherlands, there had developed a faction among the Reformed clergy who definitely and clearly broke with Calvinism on his understanding of predestination. So I want to talk a little bit about that. The name of the anti-Calvinist leader was Jacob Arminius, and the kind of theology that he developed has come to be known as Arminianism, and it is still this to this day a major force within Reformed Protestantism. Denominations like the Methodists, for example, are officially Arminian. So it's good for us to know a little bit about that, because it will also play into this question of the division in the Church of England under Charles I. Jacob Arminius was a Dutch clergyman at the end of the 16th, early 17th century. He died in 1609, who basically contended that Calvin was wrong in his understanding of predestination. Listeners probably know that Calvin taught a doctrine of double predestination, in which God chose some for heaven and others for hell. He did it for reasons known only to himself. The choice was not conditioned by anything in the human being that God chose for one or the other. And Arminius said, that's just plain wrong. God chose on the basis of how people would respond to the gospel. If somebody believed, God chose them for heaven. If somebody refused to believe, didn't believe, God chose them for hell. So predestination from Arminius's position was conditioned by whether someone believed or not. This led Arminius to challenge another presupposition of Calvinism, and that was, for whom did Christ die? Arminius said the atonement, Christ's death, was universal. It was for everybody. Whereas in classical Calvinism, even though Christ's death might have paid for all sins, it was effectual. It was only aimed at the elect, those whom God had chosen to receive the benefits of Christ's death. So you had another distinction then between Arminius and Calvin. A third one, also very important, had to do with whether you could fall from grace. Calvin had taught, once saved, always saved. That is, if somebody was truly a believer, that meant he was truly elect, that was guaranteed he would never fully fall from his faith, fall from Christianity. Arminius said, no, we have examples of people falling. You can fall from grace. Now, Arminius is a little vague on this, but later Arminians much less so, and that is, how do you come to faith? Well, the Arminian position was that God offers grace, and then you exercise your free will to accept that offer of grace. So that the Arminian position kind of exalted human nature and human free will, whereas Calvin and the Calvinist rejected that. No, human free will was a myth. Human beings, because of original sin, were born blind, dead, enemies of God. So we had these two different viewpoints going at each other in the Dutch Netherlands at the beginning of the 17th century. Eventually, the Reformed churches solved that theologically by a big conference in the Netherlands in 1618, 1619. It's known as the Synod of Dort. And to that synod, it was basically the Dutch Calvinist Reformed Church that held this under the auspices of the Dutch government. But delegates from all of the Reformed churches, including even from England, went there to duke it out on this question of who was right, Calvin or Arminius. Arminius was dead, but his followers were there. Make a long story short, the Synod of Dort decided in favor of Calvinism, and the English delegates sent by King James agreed with that decision. And that decision has been memorialized in TULIP. Maybe some of your listeners are familiar with that. It's kind of five-point Calvinism. And it comes down to human sin, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, preservation of the saints. All the stuff that we put together in a package that we describe as Calvinism. But there was the opposite position, the Arminian position. And now my bottom line is that those two positions also came to be known about, discussed, and even held in England at the time of James and clearly at the time of Charles I as well. So the Continental Division found its representation also in the Church of England, where the Arminian position is kind of it's amorphous. Nobody's coming out and arguing about it all the time. But nonetheless, the Calvinist concession in the Church of England is being disputed by at least some in the Church of England during that reign of James I. Now, I've gone on here for a while, so let me pause and see if you guys have any questions about that.
No, this is really helpful to understand Arminianism in this context and that Arminius versus Calvin, those questions. I know a lot of, if we know anything about denominations in America today, understanding that difference. I know we'll get to how this all connects to American denominations, but understanding that foundation is very important. And it's a little early, but we're going to take a break right now before we get into the next part of this conversation, so I don't have to interrupt you later. We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason, to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about Arminianism, Calvinism, how these two factions work themselves out in England during the time of James and then Charles. So are we getting to the reign of Charles now in the story?
Yes, I'm going to give you an episode that starts at during the reign of James and flows over into the reign of Charles.
Perfect.
I just want to make sure that the listeners understand that when we talk about this anti-Calvinist, anti-Puritan faction within the Church of England, sometimes they're called Arminian. They're not all necessarily Arminian in their theology, but they're uncomfortable with continental Calvinism for one reason or the other. And in addition to the doctrine, there are those two elements that I want to stress. These are folks who, for the most part, think that bishops have a kind of biblical divine institution as successors to the apostles. They don't want any discussion of elders and all that kind of stuff in the Presbyterian system. And the other is, they are also much more appreciative of the ceremonial heritage and the liturgical heritage of their Book of Common Prayer. And again, they've come to treasure that way of worship over against the Puritan criticisms of their making the sign of the cross and all that kind of stuff that the Puritans continued to criticize. I might also want to mention that one of the reasons that this anti-Calvinist, anti-Puritan faction developed is because the Archbishop of Canterbury, a fellow by the name of George Abbott, was pretty easygoing. And if you didn't make too much noise or racket, you could get away with stuff. So the Puritans got away with not following the Book of Common Prayer. And then this High Church Arminian faction, well, they got along with got away with advocating the kind of stuff that they wanted, because Abbott wasn't the kind of guy who was going around trying to get everybody into line. So you've got a big church with different factions, and as long as you weren't too obnoxious or too noisy, you could probably get away with what it is you wanted to get away with. Now, this changes when we come to one of these anti-Calvinist theologians by the name of Richard Montagu, who got things going in a very divisive way when he responded to a Catholic polemicist who accused the Church of England of being Calvinist. So let me pause there for a second, set this up a little better. Richard Montagu was an up-and-coming churchman in the Church of England, graduate of Cambridge, but he belongs to this anti-Puritan, anti-Calvinist wing. As a young man, he was a scholar. He was also a defender of the Church of England. So when this Catholic by the name of John Higham wrote a tract called A Gag for the New Gospel, accusing the Church of England of Calvinism, Montagu responded with a work entitled A New Gag for an Old Goose, in which he contended that the Catholic got it all wrong. that the Church of England was different and better from the Church of Rome, but it was certainly not Calvinist. And as a matter of fact, Montague said that the Church of England stood in the gap between Puritanism and Popery. And he said things about the church, about the Catholic Church, which upset others in the Church of England. So, for example, he denied transubstantiation, but he affirmed the real presence of the body and blood of Jesus. He also affirmed a positive use for images in churches. He said it wasn't, you know, making images wasn't the thing. It was profaning, worshiping images. Regarding predestination, he contended that the Calvinist position was not the position of Church of England. You, he said to this Catholic, you're arguing against the Puritan, but we are not a Puritan church. We are the Church of England. Well, this controversy between Montague and the Catholic polemicist was brought to the attention of members of Parliament in the House of Commons, and they set up a committee to investigate this. And the Puritans dominated the committee, and they argued that Montague was taking a heretical position, and they urged the Archbishop of Canterbury to force Montague to revise his book. But Montague took a different approach. He published a second work. It was an appeal to Caesar, and that meant an appeal to the king, of course, who was the supreme governor of the church. And in this work, he contended that the position of the Church of England was that human beings have a free will, rather than the Calvinist position that their will was bound. Montague wrote, "I am sure I profess of that fraternity no Calvinist, no Lutheran, but a Christian." And so he refused to be bound by the Synod of Dort. He defended Rome as a true church, a church that had errors in it, but nonetheless a true church. He denied that the Pope was the Antichrist. Regarding the real presence of the body and blood of Jesus, he said the difference between us and popish writers is only about the method, the mode, the manner of Christ's presence in the sacrament. Well, this really alarmed the House of Commons, that here they had somebody who was flagrantly rejecting Calvinism and actually saying nice things about Rome. So a House of Commons committee condemned Montague, not for heresy, but for dishonoring James by appealing to him in this matter. And James, at this point, dies. He dies in March of 1625. So in the midst of this controversy, Charles I comes to the throne. Now, already by this time, early in his rule, and we'll talk a little bit about this later, Charles is at odds with Parliament. And so to show that he wasn't going to be bossed around by Parliament, he actually appointed Montague as one of his chaplains. Church authorities, however, did hold a conference between representatives of the two factions regarding the various issues that Montague had raised in his work. Both sides were there, churchmen, peers, Puritans, anti-Puritans. They talked about whether Rome was a church. They talked about Antichrist. They talked about the sacraments. They talked about predestination. And it was clear that there were two factions, no meeting of the mind. Now, for the Calvinist, Puritan side, they were convinced that the other side, Montague's side, the Arminian side, were heretics. And as heretics, they ought to be deprived of their offices in the church. But in June of 1626, Charles I vindicated the Arminian position not by saying, oh yeah, this is right, but rather by forbidding either church or parliament anymore to debate these issues, that there should be silence on the issues that Montague raised. They'd give the issues had given much offense, the battle had given much offense, and so he wanted no more of it. But the point is, that meant that the Montague position was a legitimate position within the Church of England, and that what the opponents had thought about their church as being a Calvinist church, even with peculiarities like bishops and the Book of Common Prayer, could no longer be taken for granted. Under Charles, it would seem right at the beginning of his reign, both positions would be legitimate. And as it turned out shortly, Charles actually was in favor of that Arminian position. So let me pause there for a second. Oh, and I should add also, and he actually made Montague a little bit later one of the bishops of the Church of England. So let me just pause there for a second and see if you guys have any questions about this Montague controversy and what it means in terms of these factions I was talking about.
Any questions? Or many questions?
One question.
Okay. Well, mine is probably seems kind of random. Just the fact that a church body can hold both positions at the same time. I find that interesting.
Well, you know what? Here's what's happening. And it happens to all the state churches at one point or another. And that is, in order to hold the nation together, they end up tolerating a lot of deviations from what was once the kind of serious doctrinal position that they had affirmed at the time of the Reformation. So you can see that in Lutheranism. Now, it happens maybe a little bit later, but you know, you get the Pietists, you get the rationalists, you get the liberals. They all find a place within the state church. Because if you don't do that, then you've got a big fight, and you've got a domestic fight, and most rulers, at a certain point, they don't worry about it so much as they did in the 16th century, and so they put up with stuff. And that's kind of what develops in England. Now, at the point we're talking about, they're not, you know, Charles I is going to promote one faction, and so the other faction is going to get really upset, and they're going to end up fighting about it. But by the end of the 17th century, they will be a little bit more tolerant and willing to live with more differences for the sake of domestic peace. But we actually are a long way from that. Hope we'll get there by the end of this series, but that is coming. But anyway, that's what I think happens. State churches, in order to keep themselves going, have to be a church that's comprehensive, and that will mean tolerating a lot of stuff that a denominational church like ours or others in America wouldn't necessarily have to do.
We have about 2 minutes left. What would you like to cover in our remaining time today?
Yeah, let's just talk a little bit about Charles I then. Charles becomes king upon the death of his father in 1625. He comes at a time when there is a division in the country over religion. Yeah, and I don't want to exaggerate this. I mean, nobody was saying, oh, we've got to break off or whatever. But nonetheless, you have these serious differences. But he also comes at a time in which there is serious differences between the king and Parliament. And I want to talk just a little bit about that, because the religious questions really can't be separated from the constitutional question. So the issues we're talking about get played out in Parliament all the time. And yet we really haven't talked about what Parliament was. Parliament was a medieval institution that had grown in significance during the 16th century. It was called whenever the king wanted to call it. There were two houses, the House of Lords, were the titled nobility, and also the bishops. They were in the one house, the House of Lords. And then you had the Commons, and the Commons was an elected body. Every shire, and that means every county in England, got to send two representatives to the House of Commons, and so did each borough. And there was kind of a list of boroughs, and those, it's just an old world word for towns and cities. They got to send representatives too. So it's a representative body, but not a democratic body. You only could vote if you were a 40-shilling freeholder, and that meant just a small percentage of Englishmen could actually vote for representatives in the House of Commons, but they could vote. And they did elect people who sometimes had different points of view, especially on religious questions. And so the religious questions get played out in this representative body whenever it was called. Now, it wasn't running the government the way it does today. It was called on exceptional occasion, usually because the king needed more money, and often he needed more money in order to wage war. During the 44 years of Elizabeth, she had 13 sessions of parliament. Each lasted only about 13 weeks. So that's how irregular it was. James, king for 22 years, he summoned four parliaments. They met in 8 sessions. So it's not regular. But if the king needed extra money, he had to call it. And when he called it, they would often want to talk about other things. So that's where maybe it would be a good place for us to stop today, and we'll do some more next week.
Sounds like a very effective form of government. Well, thank you, Dr. McKenzie, for joining us today and helping us learn more about the Puritan movement. Next time, we'll continue the conversation learning more. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. McKenzie.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.